Thank you, Gary. Yes, my title is Black Holes as Mirrors. This is based on a paper that was posted on the archive about a month ago. And my collaborator is Patrick Hayden. Patrick is actually a computer science professor at McGill. He's a very interesting guy, has a physics background, and was a postdoc at Caltech. And actually, he initiated this project before I joined, and if there are any good ideas in the paper, they're very likely Patrick's ideas. So the question I want to discuss is the information retention time of a black hole. We're going to take it for granted that black holes don't destroy information, that they process it. That a quantum system that's absorbed by a black hole will eventually, in an encoded form, be revealed in the Hawking radiation. And the question is, how long is that going to take? In recent years, my main research interest has been in quantum computing and quantum information. But I thought about this question back in the early 90s. And actually, what kindled my interest in quantum computing, in a sense, was thinking about how information processing might work in the case of black holes back in the early 90s. And there was a conference here at Santa Barbara in 1993. Some of you were there and probably remember Joe and Gary and Jim and Steve. And I think Mark was there too, but he's not here. Anyway, that was the conference at which Joe famously organized a vote on information is lost or not.
Never.
And I said some things in my talk at the conference about this question. In a way, this is a reconsideration of the issues some years later. But to set the context for the discussion, I'll remind you of a standard formulation of the black hole information puzzle. So we consider the Penrose diagram of a black hole, which eventually evaporates completely. And here's the collapsing body. And here's the outgoing Hawking radiation, which eventually escapes. Oh, sure. Which eventually escapes to null isotopic infinity. And it's possible on this space-time to draw a space-like surface, which has the properties that, first of all, it avoids all areas of high curvature, so that we expect that we can use local effective field theory and semi-classical methods to analyze the physics on this slice. And furthermore, it's been chosen so that nearly all of the outgoing Hawking radiation, let's say 99% of it, crosses that surface outside the horizon. And furthermore, the collapsing body crosses the surface inside the horizon. So if it's really true that the Hawking radiation has information about the initial state of the collapsing body encoded in it, there's a curious thing, which is that information seems to be imprinted on this slice in two places, both outside the horizon in the radiation. That's assuming most of the information has come out when nearly all the Hawking radiation is emitted. So we're excluding the possibility of a long-lived remnant, which most of us don't think is a very plausible resolution of the puzzle. But then the information, if it really does come out, is in two places at once. And that means this is really a cloning scenario where a general quantum state can be copied. There are two copies of the state, maybe one in encoded form, but in principle, the state is in two places. And that violates the linearity of quantum mechanics. And so we're really stuck in a difficult situation. Either the information isn't being revealed in the Hawking radiation, which means we seem to need to reconsider the foundations of quantum theory, or it is, and then it seems that information is cloned, which also means we need to re-examine what we thought we understood about quantum mechanics. So there's a way of feeling better about this, the complementarity viewpoint that Susskind and collaborators in particular emphasized some time ago, which is maybe the right way of looking at this is, for reasons that we still don't entirely understand, but which we hope quantum gravity will explain, is that we shouldn't think of the physics on the slice as being divided into two separate subsystems, the inside part and the outside part. But the inside part and the outside part, rather, are two complementary ways of looking at the same system. So that it's not really that the information is in two places, but there are two different viewpoints, the inside viewpoint and the outside viewpoint, considering the information. And the nice thing, or a nice thing, about this complementarity perspective is it's subject to some consistency tests. Okay? Because if it's really true that information is not actually being cloned, that the cloning is fictitious, then it shouldn't be possible for any observer in the regime that we can analyze semi-classically to be able to verify the cloning. And so we can imagine this thought experiment. Now I'll draw a crustal diagram, where here is the singularity, where UV is equal to 1, where U and V are the crustal null coordinates. This is V, this is U, the horizon is U equals 0. And so we can imagine that someone who has some quantum information in her possession, Alice, has some qubits, and she carries them in to the black hole. And Bob, meanwhile, stays outside, and he waits for a while until the quantum state that Alice was originally carrying gets revealed in the Hawking radiation in some encoded form, and Bob somehow decodes it, and now he has a good fidelity copy of Alice's state. And now he himself follows Alice into the black hole in order to compare notes to see if they can verify the cloning. Bob will either receive Alice's qubits or information about measurements she performed to see if it's really true the quantum state is in two places. But as the diagram indicates, if Bob has to wait for a while, what it means is that there isn't much time for Alice, not much of Alice's proper time, for Alice to send a signal to Bob which will reach him before he enters the high curvature region, this singularity. So if you actually do this calculation and you ask how much proper time does Alice, if she follows a geodesic, have to send a signal that will reach Bob, it's constant of order 1, which depends on the initial conditions of Alice's geodesic, and there's a factor of the Schwarzschild radius, R sub s, and then the ratio of Alice's crustal coordinate when she crossed the horizon to Bob's. But the relation between the crustal coordinates and the Schwarzschild time has an exponential in it, so this really goes like this radius times a constant times the exponential of the elapsed Schwarzschild time divided by 2RS. The exponential comes in because the Schwarzschild observers are being uniformly accelerated compared to the freely falling observers. So now, if we want really everything to be semi-classical, then Alice should be able to send her signal over a proper time, which is long compared to the Planck time, because if not, she's going to have to encode her message to Bob in using a super Planckian carrier frequency, and we don't know how to analyze that situation semi-classically. So if we say that this is greater than or equal to something of order 1 in Planck units, okay, then we want this information retention time, the amount of Schwarzschild time that we have to wait before the information comes out, to be larger than something which is of order in Planck units, R log R. If it's shorter than that, if it's of order the Schwarzschild radius, then we have the cloning puzzle. It seems like it's actually possible to do this thought experiment and verify information is in two places at once, contrary to the complementary viewpoint. Okay. The conventional wisdom about information retention time, I guess, has been that we should expect to have to wait a time comparable to the lifetime of the black hole, its evaporation lifetime, for information to be revealed. That would mean, since the lifetime goes like the Schwarzschild radius cubed, it would be a time much longer than this time where we'd be in danger of encountering a colonial paradox. Now, the reason that you might believe that it takes a time comparable to the lifetime uses a picture which I think I first heard clearly expressed by Don Page some time ago of the entropy of the radiation being emitted by an evaporating black hole, where if we consider the entropy of the radiation as a function of the amount of Hawking-Bekenstein entropy that's been radiated away by the black hole, which goes like its initial mass squared divided by mass squared. The entropy just rises linearly for a while, which means that it's a completely mixed or completely thermal state, which is featureless and revealing no information. Until we get to the halfway point, where half the initial entropy has been radiated away. And the picture up to now we can think of as the black hole has microscopic degrees of freedom. The black hole is bigger than the radiation system, and so the radiation is essentially maximally entangled with the black hole, and so it has a completely mixed density operator. But once the radiation and the black hole are systems of equal dimension, that will no longer be the case as the evaporation continues, and instead we should think of the black hole internal degrees of freedom as being maximally entangled with the subsystem of the radiation. The entropy starts to come back down, eventually returning to purity at the endpoint of evaporation. So this is where information is escaping. But the escape doesn't really begin until about half the entropy has been radiated away, and that takes a time comparable to the evaporation lifetime. That's the RQ.
Are there any assumptions that go into this, or does this apply to any system?
There's an assumption which goes into it, which is that you can think of the decomposition into two subsystems as being selected randomly. If you do that, then you can compute the entropy and see that this approximation of maximal entanglement of the smaller subsystem is true to an excellent approximation to a it's the deviation of the entropy from maximal goes like the ratio of the two dimensions. So if one system is much bigger than the other, then the entropy is essentially as large as it can be, which means there's no information. Now, it may or may not be a good dynamical hypothesis that you can think of the subsystem as being selected randomly, but that's really the assumption that goes into the picture.
You couldn't get a longer time at which the information comes out if it's got to come out, right?
Right.
Okay. So that's sort of assumption independent, isn't it?
Oh, well, you mean it couldn't be a longer time than the lifetime of the black hole?
Or the half-life when it starts to come out, basically.
Okay.
Is that correct? That seems reasonable to me.
I think that's correct.
Okay.
But, of course, what's being said here is stronger, which is if you believe the picture, it doesn't come out until the radiation system.
Yeah, it could always come out earlier, but it's got to start coming out by the MQ time. Okay.
So this is the, Patrick really raised the question, could this picture be seriously wrong? And I'm going to argue, that's what the title means, that it might be seriously wrong, that the information might return faster than you would naively expect. And part of the argument I'll be able to frame in a fairly precise mathematical way, but part of it is actually quite speculative and tentative, and I'll try to separate the two, and I'll save the tentative part nearer the end. Okay. It's probably, okay. So to get started, I guess you could argue that I've started already, but to pave the way for what I want to say later on, I'd like to consider a very simple classical model of a black hole, because that'll be a context in which it's very clear what I'm claiming, that uses the ideas that I want to then extend to a quantum model of a black hole, which we'll then proceed to discuss. So let's start with this classical model. It's So I'm going to be talking about classical information at
first, in other words. What we're really interested in is quantum information, information encoded in a quantum state.
For my classical model, Alice's message is just a bit string. It's k bits. Okay. So Alice has k bits. And the black hole is also just some classical system which I can encode in bits. So I can think of that as initially n minus k bits, and where we'll imagine that the black hole is big, so n is a lot bigger than k. And then Alice drops her
squeezed a little tears.
The Alice's bits get mixed into the internal state of the black hole. If we can imagine that the k bits get appended to the n minus k bits. But then there's some transformation that mixes up the new information introduced by Alice with the previous internal state of the black hole. And I'll say in a minute how I'm going to model that. And then radiation gets emitted for a while, and so S bits are revealed by the black hole, and those are going to be acquired by Bob, who's going to try to figure out what message Alice had. And then what remains will still be in the black hole, the later state of the black hole.
Okay.
So the way I'm going to model the mixing is I want to have some reversible transformation on bit strings. So that's just a permutation of all the possible bit strings. A permutation of a 2 to the n bit strings. And I want to imagine that that's deterministic. It's fixed by the internal dynamics of a black hole, but I don't know what it is. So I'm just going to consider a typical permutation. I'm going to imagine selecting that permutation uniformly from among all permutations.
Okay.
So what that means is that Alice's k bits become encoded. Well, Alice's message, or the possible messages that Alice could be sending, each message corresponds to a bit string of length n, and they're all together 2 to the k of them. And those strings are just selected at random in my model. Okay. And now Bob is going to start to receive one bit after another after this permutation. But you see, Bob knows a lot. He knows the internal state of the black hole because he knows all about the laws of black hole dynamics. He's been observing this black hole since it formed. He knows what the permutation is. He knows what the initial state is. All he doesn't know to start with is Alice's message, those k bits. So he's got a big, yeah.
Just to clarify, when you say the permutation is random, you mean that we in the room here don't know what it is, but
right.
Bob knows what it is.
Bob, that's correct. That's important. Bob knows what it is. But what I want to say is I'm going to make a statement about Bob's ability to decode, and it will be true for typical permutations. In fact, it will be true for almost any permutation. As long as he knows what it is, right.
So that's just a genericity statement, really.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But I'm saying there's some dynamics. Bob knows what it is, and almost no matter what it is, he's going to be able to decode pretty quickly.
Okay.
Because it's pretty simple to analyze this, because Bob's got a big code book. He's got a list of the 2 to the k strings which actually point to messages. Okay? And the bits start to come out. And each time he sees another bit, he can eliminate a lot of lines from the code book until finally there's just one string whose first S bits match one of the lines in the code book, and now he knows what the message is. In order for a failure to occur, there have to be, once he sees the first S bits, more than one message which matches the first S bits of one of the 2 to the k strings in the code book. So the probability of failure occurs if there's more than one string aside from the valid one which matches the first S bits that Bob has seen. And so that means one of the other, and they're 2 to the k minus 1, what we'll call it 2 to the k, one of the invalid strings has to match. But for each bit to match, because we've chosen the strings at random, the probability of a match is just 1/2 bit by bit.
When you say a bit string, can I think of this as a sequence of ones and zeros?
Yeah.
I can really think of it, so it's just so the picture is that, okay, so, and is that sufficient? I mean, that's very classical, but that's sufficient to...
Well, everything's classical so far. We're going to try to, next we're going to think about how to make it quantum.
Right.
Okay.
I see. Right. But the idea was the black hole was going to emit a sequence of ones and zeros, which Bob knew, and now it's emitting a different sequence of ones and zeros.
Right. And the reason Bob now doesn't have a priori knowledge is because Alice has thrown in the k bits.
Right.
He doesn't know at first what they are, but each time he learns another bit, he finds out more about what Alice's message is, because he can eliminate more and more of the 2 to the k possible messages. So finally, there's just one left, and then Bob is decoded.
But he could also have done the same thing by looking at the last S bits instead of the next S bits.
Oh, yeah. So, there's some random order, which is the order in which we're imagining as the black hole evaporates,
right.
It starts revealing.
So there's
it's a canonical order.
There's zeroing of information here, which there wouldn't be for a quantum system. For a quantum system, he couldn't have found the information. If the information is in the first S bits, it's not also in the last S bits.
Oh, I see.
So this system somehow is
able to
get more information out than a quantum system can.
Well, in other words... he can look at different substrings, any
right.
one of which reveal the same information in the classical case.
Yes.
Right. Okay, but you can see how the probability of failure is going to behave, because for an S-bit string to match by accident one of the encoded messages different from the correct one, that's the probability of that is just 1/2 to the S. Okay, so if S is K plus a little bit more, some constant, this is going to be small if the constant is large enough. All right, so if Alice throws in, 1,000 bits and once Bob has 1,100 back, the probability that he hasn't decoded correctly is completely negligible. So he just needs the length of Alice's message plus a little more, and he can decode with high probability of success for a typical permutation, and in fact for almost any permutation. So this is, in this context, is what I mean by a black hole as a mirror. The information comes right back in the sense that Alice throws in k bits, and a little bit more than k come back, and Bob knows Alice's message. Now, it's an unusual kind of mirror because Bob had to know some things to read the reflection. He had to know the initial internal state of the black hole. He had to know the dynamics of the black hole. He had to know the permutation. But if he knows these things, the information bounces right back in this model. So let me just say for your edification that what I've just described is phrased in an unusual way, something that's standard in information theory. Information theorists like to talk about communication through noisy channels, and they speak of the capacity, which is the maximum rate at which information can be encoded and sent through a noisy channel and then recovered with negligible probability of error. Okay, so in this case, we can think of the channel as being an erasure channel. Some of the bits are not available to Bob. They've been erased, if you like. He only gets the S bits that come out. As far as Bob is concerned, the others have been erased. Okay, so the erasure probability, if you like, is the number of bits that are erased, which is the number that's still in the black hole, n minus k minus this constant, and then divided by the total number of bits n. And the rate, what I mean by the rate, is the number of message bits per bit transmitted. That's k over n. So this is just 1 minus the rate minus something that's negligible if I consider n large with C fixed. So, in fact, for an erasure channel which has erasure probability P, the capacity is just 1 minus P. So, in other words, this is the best possible encoding for achieving the highest rate for an erasure channel. So there are really two things going on here that are well known. One is that the capacity of the erasure channel in the classical case is 1 minus P, where P is the erasure probability. And second, that random encodings are actually optimal. I mean, if you choose almost any encoding, it achieves the optimal rate.
Maybe.
Yeah.
At this point, just a comment, which is one of the to you before, but for the benefit of others. So since you've said the mirror statement, so I guess the reflection time is the longer of the assumed thermalization time.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned
put in, and the time that comes from this. So right. If you push up the thermalization time,
so in my dynamical assumption was that thermalization is instantaneous, that this mixing transformation occurs right away before any bits of radiation have been emitted. Okay, so far we modeled thermalization as something that occurs right away before any of the so-called Hawking radiation in this model starts to leak out. So in general, it could have been some other permutation which was far from typical. Okay. And then, of course, the story would be different. And that would correspond to the thermalization not being as fast. But, you know, there's kind of something that's marvelous about that. But by modeling it as a typical permutation, I'm kind of saying, well, I want to think of this classical black hole as the best thermalizer it can be. It takes Alice's bits, and it mixes them up in such a way that they're, as non-locally as possible encoded in the internal state of the black hole. But that's actually the best thing for the encoder to do in order to protect against erasure. So the best thermalizer is the best encoding.
But it's also the furthest from the semi-classical approximation, too.
Well, everything's classical, so.
Well, oh, sorry. In the black hole context, right. It's furthest from the semi-classical approximation.
Right. In fact, your assumption is not just that it's not exactly that, well, it doesn't have to be encoded very non-locally in terms of the internal state of the black hole. It just needs to be encoded non-locally in terms of the output stream of Hawking radiation, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So you're saying I'm making a slightly stronger assumption than is really necessary. But what I am assuming is that the important thing is we're not talking about a permutation of the bits. We're talking about a permutation of the bit string. So the dynamics is matching each input bit string to some random bit string. But there could be other models of the dynamics for which we could still achieve the capacity besides this one. This one is particularly natural.
Could you say a few words about the thermalization issue, though? I mean, when you use the word thermalization in your conversation with Steve, and when we talk about thermalization in other contexts, do we really mean this sort of maximal mixing?
Normally we don't, but I'd like to postpone the question.
Okay.
Because I do want to address it later on. But first I want to talk about this quantum model, which has some of the features of the classical one, but it's getting a little bit closer to what we're really interested in. But what the quantum model that I'll first discuss will share with the classical model is that I'll assume that there's a very strongly mixing transformation that occurs very quickly before the radiation starts to come out. And then we'll have to re-examine that and whether that's physically reasonable. So I kind of like to continue with the same story. I'd like to imagine that now there's some deterministic dynamics of a black hole. I just want to think of a black hole as having some number of bits stored in its microscopic state, and there's some unitary transformation that acts on that. Okay, and Bob knows it because he's a brilliant physicist who knows the laws of black hole dynamics. And there's going to be some, now not a classical message, but a k-qubit quantum state, which Alice is going to drop into the black hole. Now, in the classical model, I assume that Bob knew the initial state of the black hole. What does it mean to know a quantum state? You know, you can't even write down a succinct description of a quantum state for a large system. But really what I meant when I said that Bob knew it is that Bob had a record that was perfectly correlated with the internal state, which he was able to use when he decoded. And that there is a quantum analog of that assumption. We can imagine that Bob has a system which is maximally correlated with the internal state of the black hole, in other words, maximally entangled with it. Now, that may seem like a very strong assumption, but it's in fact exactly what I was describing here. If we imagine that a black hole forms, it evaporates for a long time, and then until more than half of its initial entropy has been radiated away, now the internal state of the black hole is, to a very good approximation, maximally entangled with the subsystem of the radiation. So I want to imagine I'm in that situation now. We're giving Bob the power to control all that radiation. He has a system which is maximally entangled with the internal state of the black hole. Alice throws in some unknown quantum system, the black hole evaporates for a while. Now Bob's going to try to decode. Now decode doesn't mean construct a classical description. It means transform some of the radiation into a quantum state in Bob's laboratory, which is essentially the same state as Alice originally threw in. So the picture now is going to be like this. So here I'm going to have this mixing transformation. We'll come back to how we model that in a second. Initially, the black hole is maximally entangled with this radiation system. This is the radiation that's been emitted for a long time, and Bob has that system. And now Alice is going to send in her message, I'll call it M, her message. And it's convenient to imagine that Alice actually has a reference system which is entangled with her message system, because this makes it particularly transparent how to analyze the what happens to the information. So I'm going to imagine there's a reference system, I'll call it N. Time's going up. These are both supposed to represent maximal entanglement of the black hole with the previously emitted radiation and of Alice's message with her reference system. Okay. And now...
Sorry, John. Yeah. The reference system stays outside the black hole.
Yeah, so the reference system, it's really just a mathematical convenience. I could have described this differently, and it's much easier to analyze it in this language, and that's why I'm doing it. But I could have just said Alice threw in a pure state, a KQ, a 2 to the K dimensional Hilbert space. She picked some pure state, and she threw it in, and Bob's trying to get that state. But you'll see in a minute why I want to describe it this way. It makes it easier to analyze. Well, let me explain what the idea is. If Bob can recover, in fact, I'm going to call, I think this is what I did in the paper, I'm going to call E what was emitted earlier, and then there's R which gets emitted later, and Bob has both. And if Bob can recover as a subsystem of this previously emitted radiation and the information that was emitted after Alice's system was absorbed by the black hole, a state which is very nearly maximally entangled with the reference system, that means that Bob has the information. That's actually equivalent to saying for any pure state that Alice put in, Bob will be able to get his hands on that pure state. If he can do that for any pure state, then he'll be able to recover a system which is maximally entangled with the reference system. So it's a convenient way of describing what it means for Bob to recover the information.
One other question. So if Bob doesn't know the initial state of the black hole, wasn't watching, but then shows up and...
Well, he doesn't really know it here. Instead, he has this system which is maximally entangled with the
information. So that was my question. If he only sees the radiation that the black hole emits and gets all the photons coming out until half the mass has been evaporated, mm-hmm. that's good enough.
You see, that's the assumption. Right. That's what he's got.
Okay, well, that's good. Okay, yeah, so you that's don't all need to know
anything. So it's not crazy. But Bob's very powerful. He's collected all of the radiation that's been emitted for the whole lifetime of the black hole, but he didn't have to prepare the black hole in any exotic ways, generic in that sense. And then the rest of what goes out here is just the final state of the black hole, V prime.
He had to know how he prepared it to or not?
No.
Okay, yeah.
No. So all he's got to know is that he's got a state which is maximally entangled with the internal state of the black hole. And he's got to know what this transformation is if he's going to decode, just like he did before. He needed to know what the permutation was in the classical model. It's going to be some unitary transformation. Okay, we're going to have n minus k bits initially. We throw in k more. Now we've got n bits. Call that the black hole system B. And we're going to suppose there's some unitary transformation chosen deterministically applied to it. Now I'm going to use the same method of analysis as before. I'm going to say, let's consider a typical unitary transformation. And typical means here chosen uniformly with respect to the Haar measure on the unitary group. Okay? And I'm going to assume the mixing is rapid again. So the mixing transformation occurs on a time scale which is short compared to the time to emit many radiation quanta in the Hawking radiation. Okay, and I want to know, is Bob going to be able to get his hands on a system which is maximally entangled with the reference system? But you see, the nice way about doing it this way is that we actually have a pure state of the system consisting of E, R, B prime, M. Okay, and initially,
before the mixing transformation and before the radiation starts to get emitted,
the reference system is going to be correlated with the internal state of the black hole. It's going to be maximally entangled with the subsystem of it. But those correlations are going to decay as radiation gets emitted by the black hole, as the system R grows in size. Okay, and eventually, those correlations are going to become essentially negligible. The density operator is going to turn into a product state. There's no correlation anymore between B prime and N, and that means N has to be maximally entangled with a subsystem of ER, which in principle Bob can dig out with some decoding transformation. Okay, so what we want to do, in other words, is we want to consider the density operator of NB prime, the reference system, and what's left in the black hole. And we want to know how far does it deviate from a product state. In fact, this is going to depend. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to suppose there's some canonical decomposition, just like before we had some canonical ordering of the bits. There's some canonical decomposition of this N qubit space into the initial black hole and the K qubits that Alice added. And then we're going to apply some unitary to that. We're going to have a canonical decomposition, let's say, into B prime and R. And then after applying the uniform, after applying that unitary, then we trace out R. And that's how we get this density operator of NB prime. So it depends on that unitary transformation. And we want to ask, how far does it deviate from a product? And actually, we can consider its deviation from... This just means the featureless density operator, the completely mixed density operator. I guess that's right. And now I want to look at if we have to use the right measure of distance when we talk about the distance, I should use the L1 distance, the norm that's defined by the trace of the square root of A adjoint A, not the Hilbert-Schmidt distance, the square root of the trace. This is the right measure of distance to use because if states are very close in the L1 norm, you can prove that they're essentially indistinguishable by any conceivable measurement. And that turns out to be the right criterion for showing that Bob's decoding map can be constructed, details of which I'm not going to discuss. And in fact, I'm not going to say in detail how we do this calculation, but I will say it involves things that you probably, a lot of you know how to do. But what the result turns out to be is that this is less than or equal to the dimension of the reference system divided by the dimension of the radiation system. The bars just mean the dimension of these subsystems. And so, in other words, if Alice has k qubits, so the dimension of the reference system is 2 to the k, and a k plus constant qubits are emitted in the radiation, this again is 2 to the minus this constant. So the statement is that if we consider this, I forgot to say I'm averaging, I'm integrating over Haar measure, normalized Haar measure. So really, again, the statement is if I consider some typical unitary, then after the radiation system is a little bit bigger than the reference system, this is going to be very close to a product state. So it's just like in the classical case. We have a little bit more than k qubits coming back in the radiation. And at that point, the correlations between the black hole and the reference system have been destroyed. The reference system is now correlated with the system that Bob holds, which consists of the previously emitted radiation that he had to begin with, and now the new radiation that's been emitted, of which there's just k plus a little bit more qubits, after Alice's message was sent in. So in this model still, we have this metaphor that the black hole is like a mirror, assuming Bob knows the internal dynamics, assuming the black hole is initially maximally entangled with the previously emitted radiation. You don't have to wait for many qubits to come out before you can recover the quantum state that Alice put in. Very much like a classical model in that regard.
Now, what about Joe's question? I mean, if you don't look at the first k qubits that come out, but wait a while, and then is it true that the information is in any set of k qubits down the road?
Yeah, it doesn't really matter for this discussion. Well, it's not quite like what you said, but it is interesting to note that there was nothing special about the subsystem M. So M could have been any subsystem of the black hole. And no matter what subsystem we happen to be interested in, mm-hmm. it's possible for Bob to decode that subsystem when the amount of radiation that's been emitted is just a little bit bigger than that subsystem. He uses a different decoding map depending on what subsystem he's interested in. Okay, but of course, the same calculation would apply to any subsystem. Now, the only thing that Bob can't do is, although he can, let's say there are two different subsystems of the state of the black hole at this time, and he'd like to be able to recover, you know, system M1, he can do that if it has k qubits. M2, he can do that, but he can't have both. He can't have both. The decoding of M1 interferes with his ability to decode M2. If he wants them both, he'll have to wait for more radiation to be emitted.
I see. So the information in Alice's state could be extracted at any time, but you can't do it repeatedly somehow. You can't get it out.
Well, actually, you know, there's something that comes up in this context, which is, well, we could ask, what if it's a young black hole, which isn't maximally entangled with the radiation to start with, and then, just like in this picture, for a while, the radiation is featureless, and it doesn't reveal anything about what Alice threw in. But we get to the halfway point, and then the information pops out right away. At least, again, if we can say the mixing is rapid. So no matter what, it doesn't matter which k qubits we're interested in, there's some particular k qubits in the initial state we care about, we only have to wait for the halfway point plus k plus constant more qubits to come back to recover those k qubits, no matter what they are. But we do have to wait until the halfway point to learn anything.
That's in some sense just a consequence of this picture, right?
Well, but it's stronger, you see? It's stronger because here we weren't talking about what if you wanted to decode some subsystem. We were just talking about, you know, what's the entropy.
Yeah.
I mean, in a way, you're right. It is. It is the same phenomenon. But it doesn't matter, you know, what subsystem you want. You know, you might want one and Joe might want another one. And you can't both have what you want, but the information is there in kind of a random access way. If there are k qubits that you want, you can have them. And if Joe gets to decide he wants some other k qubits, he can have those.
Right.
So that wasn't really implicit, I think, in Page's original discussion.
Isn't it kind of like saying that, maybe it is different, but it sounds like it's like saying that if I wanted some k qubits, and I see from Page's argument that that the entropy has decreased quite a bit, mm-hmm. then it seems to say that I've recovered a lot of information.
Yeah.
And the odds of my k qubits that I want being in that information are quite high.
Well, okay. I mean, I can't argue with you because you're right. Unfortunately.
Is that the essence of this argument said that way, or is it very different?
Well, no, I think the essence of it is similar to what this picture suggests. But it wasn't obvious to me until thinking it through it's true in exactly this sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, that the information is there in a random access sense, and whatever you want to decode, you can decode and no more.
Yeah, it seems surprising. I mean, when things it comes out kind of uniformly.
Right. And you might have to wait for the thing that you're interested in for a lot of the evaporation to occur, but that's not true. So again, there's an information theorist way of saying this, which I'll just mention in passing. We can talk about something called the entanglement assisted
So are you going to say, I mean, if we had a ball of hot gas instead of a black hole,
it's the same thing, isn't it? You model the mixing the same way, it's the same conclusion. Didn't I used the word black hole, but really I meant some physical system for which I can think of the mixing as being described by a unitary that's typical, with typicality defined by the Haar measure, and fast. There's something called the entanglement-assisted quantum capacity, and that's the rate at which quantum information can be sent through a noisy channel in the case where the encoder and the decoder share some entanglement. And that's the case here. The encoder is the black hole, and it has some a subsystem which is entangled with the subsystem that the decoder has. So this is the situation that is envisioned when one speaks of the entanglement-assisted quantum capacity. This is an erasure channel again, because some of the system remains hidden from the decoder. That's what's still in the black hole. And so the statement is that the entanglement-assisted quantum capacity, when a fraction p of the qubits is erased, it's again 1 minus p, the same as the classical result of the answer to a different question. Okay. So now we've got to come back to these issues that you've been raising about the thermalization time. And here, there's something I can say which I can make mathematically precise, but then to try to reach a conclusion about thermalization time in terms of Schwarzschild time, I have to be on much less solid ground, as we'll see. But anyway, if you take this picture seriously, what is it saying? By saying the mixing is very fast, what I meant by that is the mixing occurs before the radiation starts to leak out. And so the time scale there, in the case of a Schwarzschild black hole, is it emits about one quantum every time RS in Schwarzschild time. So here, the assumption in the case of a black hole is that the mixing time is actually, if we had k qubits, they come out in a time which is about k times the Schwarzschild radius, because, you know, roughly speaking, each quantum carries away an order of one amount of entropy. And so KRS is the retention time if the thermalization is fast. And fast means that we need to have it be fast compared to this time. Okay. So let's say less than KRS. So if we're interested, we could consider just Alice having some constant size system. So K is just order one. And if the mixing time is of order the Schwarzschild radius, then the information retention time is also of order RS. And that's too fast, according to the cloning argument I gave at the beginning. So that certainly encourages us to examine a little more closely what the mixing time might be. Now, there's a respect in which you might say that you can think, and this comes back to the question of, is what I mean by the mixing time what people often mean when they say the mixing time? There's a sense in which you could say you expect the thermalization time for a Schwarzschild black hole to be of the order of RS. And for example, if you just consider the classical case and study the quasi-normal modes of a black hole that's perturbed, they dissipate, they ring down, and the characteristic time determined by the imaginary part of quasi-normal mode frequencies is about the Schwarzschild radius. And for that matter, this is also the order of 1 over the h bar c equal to 1. This is of order 1 over the Hawking temperature. And that kind of makes sense, for example, insofar as our ADS-CFT intuition applies. We can think of the black hole as being dual to a strongly coupled field theory at a temperature equal to the Hawking temperature. And because it's strongly coupled, if you kick the thermal bath, the time you would expect it to relax back to equilibrium is 4 of the temperature. But I would say that is the answer to a different question. That's the answer to the question, what's the time scale for local observables to behave like they do in equilibrium? But we're really asking a global question here. And we're really demanding that the information that gets absorbed be thoroughly mixed with all the degrees of freedom of the black hole. And that's not the question, I think, that's being addressed here. So now, we have to have some, if we're going to go further, we have to have some kind of picture of the dynamics that's responsible for the mixing. And that's kind of hard because it's really it's a strongly coupled quantum gravity problem. If you take the point of view of the the membrane paradigm complementary point of view, it's been argued that you should think of the outside observer's point of view, in which if you consider static Schwarzschild observers who are lowered very close to the horizon where the locally measured temperature is of the order of the Planck scale, that there's a very strongly coupled Planckian soup. And from the outside observer's point of view, that is where the information is getting deposited and processed. So we're trying to come up with some kind of dynamical description of the dynamics of this Planckian goo stuck at the horizon. And I don't know exactly how to describe that. But let me just make the comment that computer scientists have ways of talking about the complexity of unitary transformations, like they talk about the complexity of many things. And we can see what some of those tools tell us, or potentially tell us, about this situation. So what I have in mind as a measure of complexity is what's called circuit complexity. Which is a natural thing to talk about if you're trying to characterize the complexity of quantum algorithms that could run on a quantum computer. But the idea of circuit complexity is we imagine that there's some natural decomposition of a big system into small subsystems like the qubits. And that really physically comes from some notion of spatial locality. So if I think of the picture that John Wheeler likes to draw, in which the black hole is covered by little bits, each with a bit of information sitting in an area which is about order one in Planck units. But they're qubits, they're not bits. Then that's the natural decomposition, this local decomposition, let's say, on the horizon two sphere. And then with respect to some decomposition, I can ask, how long does it take to build up a unitary transformation of interest out of quantum gates that act on a pair of qubits at a time? So let's say that a gate acts on a pair of qubits. And for now, I'll say any pair of qubits. And what we really probably are interested in is some geometrical constraint that only the nearby guys can interact, describe this thing. Dynamical process. But then what I mean by the circuit size, which is one measure of complexity, is the number of gates, the minimal number, that I need to build up the unitary transformation I'm interested in, or to get a very good approximation to it. And the circuit depth is equal to the number of time steps in this computation, which might be much shorter than the circuit size if the computation is highly parallelized, if there are many gates acting in each time step. Okay? And so this is the way, if I were to think of what the black hole is doing as performing some quantum computation, I would try to quantify how hard that computation is in terms of the size and the depth. And the depth is some kind of measure of how fast that unitary transformation gets generated. Okay? Now, if I really want to think of my transformation as being typical with respect to Haar measure, that's hard. That requires to sample uniformly with respect to Haar measure takes very big circuits. It's because the volume of the group is so darn big. The dimension of The unitary group acting on n qubits is actually 4 to the n. And so the volume of the group I can think of as being some number raised to a power which is 4 to the n. In other words, if I wanted to cover all of the unitary group acting on n qubits by little balls, you know, with epsilon, you know, size epsilon, so that I am within epsilon of any possible transformation, the number of balls that I would need would grow double exponentially with the number of qubits. Now, if I count circuits, if I count the number of circuits that have size L, the number of circuits, that increases exponentially with L. There's like some number, at least roughly speaking, to the L, because each time I add another gate, I can choose it in a variety of different ways. So the number of different possible circuits grows by a factor each time I increase the size of the circuit. So if I want to have enough circuits to correspond to each one of these balls, I would have to have a circuit size which is exponential, like 4 to the n. Okay, so that would mean the computation I'd need to do to sample from Haar measure would be completely intractable. It would require computation whose size and depth increases exponentially with the number of qubits in the black hole and the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy in this case. Okay? So we can't really sample from Haar measure. But you see, we don't really need to do that. We only have to do something that's equivalent to sampling from Haar measure for our particular purpose. And that particular purpose is making this small. Okay, and if you look at how, I guess I was going to say more about this at the time, but I forgot. I'm almost out of time. How do you do this? Well, if you actually consider not the L1 norm, but the L2 norm, and you squared it, you're really evaluating here a polynomial in the unitary, which is second order in V and second order in V adjoint. So what you have to, the integral that you have to do looks like an integral with respect to Haar measure, or something with two powers of V and two powers of V adjoint. And it's easy to figure out what that is, because it's some invariant tensor, because it's, you're integrating over the group measure, and it has to have certain symmetry properties, and you can just write down what it is. So you can do that calculation, and then there's, you do a little Cauchy-Schwarz stuff to get this inequality, and that's how I did this, okay? So really, all we need is, we don't have to sample with respect to Haar measure, we can sample with respect to something which would agree with Haar measure for the purpose of doing this calculation. And something that does that is called a unitary 2 design. So if you sum over elements of a unitary 2 design, this is the definition of what a unitary 2 design is, and you consider a 2 comma 2 polynomial with 2 V's and 2 V adjoints, and it agrees with integrating over Haar measure, that's a 2 design. Okay. Well, there are actually 2 designs which are finite subgroups of the unitary group. Something called the Clifford group is a 2 design. A unitary 2 design equals the Clifford group. And the Clifford group is this. It's a unitary transformation such that if you conjugate a poly operator, a tensor product of poly matrices, product of n poly matrices, by that unitary, you get another poly operator. That's the Clifford group. And the group has an order, which is exponential in n squared. So you might expect, and it's true, that you can reconstruct circuits which are much smaller than these, which actually have a size of order n squared, where n is the total number of qubits, which can reach any element of the Clifford group. Okay, so that means there can be some randomized circuit, essentially some randomly chosen Clifford circuit, which is pretty small, and it gives us the same result as we got when we sampled with respect to Haar measure. Well, we can even go a little further than that. If we're willing to accept some error, there's something which is called an epsilon approximate. And the analysis of this is pretty recent. It was done in 2006. epsilon approximate unitary 2 design, and so what that means is that there's some correction to this n over r, but it's of order epsilon. In fact, it is epsilon, and then plus something which is negligible. So if we're willing to accept the information being approximately in Bob's hands, but with some small loss of fidelity, then it's good enough for us to consider averaging over one of these epsilon approximate two designs. So what's interesting about that is you can ask, how big a circuit do you need to sample fairly from these epsilon approximate unitary two designs? And a result from a paper last year by Dankert et al. Is that it's good enough to have circuit size, which is of order n times a log of 1 over epsilon, and circuit depth, which is order log n times log 1 over epsilon. So we can think of epsilon as being some fixed quantity determined by how accurately we're willing to accept Bob's decoding. And then so the conclusion is that these unitaries are actually pretty easy to generate. It takes a circuit which only has a depth, which can be executed in a time, which goes like a log n, to, if we can sample from such small circuits, this condition is pretty well satisfied, and the information comes out fast. Now, so far, I haven't taken into account geometrical locality constraints. Like I said, I'm actually assuming so far that we can apply a 2-qubit gate to any 2 qubits, say, on the horizon 2 sphere. There's an additional cost, then, if I can only do local gates, the time it takes for information to propagate from one location to the other. But that's going to take a number of gates, which is determined by the linear size. Okay, so we're interested in the case where the entropy, n, goes like the area, rs squared, you know, it's the Hawking-Bekenstein entropy. So rs goes like the square root of n. And so there's an extra factor if we're limited to a local surface, a local circuit acting on a surface, and this depth becomes order RS log RS. Okay. So we're far from sampling with respect to R, but we can consider circuits which one knows how to construct, which involve some tossing of coins, probabilistic circuits, which are pretty small, and those unitaries too will have this property that if we mix as described by those unitaries, information comes out quickly.
But again, this is now not the generic circuit.
Well, it's not, and so this is the end of the part where I can make precise statements. Okay. However, something I'm pretty confident of, but I haven't proved, is that if we consider local circuits, which are randomly generated, they do at least this well. There are special circuits that we know how to construct, for which thermalize, on this time scale as measured by the depth of the circuit. And they have some special structure.
That's local on the horizon.
Local on the horizon, correct, right. And so suppose we actually considered just picking our, in each time step, we have about n qubits, and each qubit interacts with one of its neighbors, so there's of order n gates being performed in each time step, and they're chosen more or less at random. I think it's a highly plausible conjecture that for the purpose of this that would all still be an epsilon approximate unitary 2 design. That would agree to good accuracy with sampling from Haar measure for the purpose of this calculation.
You say a general local circuit.
Right, general local circuit. So I think a typical local circuits will do what this special one does. Okay. Now, so if that's true, then these typical circuits will actually thermalize for our purpose in a number of time steps, which is R log R. Okay. Now we have to close the argument, we have to relate this counting of time steps, if any or such relationship really exists, to physical time. Okay. And so this is where this is a very tentative part.
And also this comment that the circuit acts locally in the fashion you've assumed on the horizon.
That's part of the assumption, right, which you could certainly question.
Yeah.
Right, so the question, so the picture is based on, you know, taking the outside observer's point of view, saying that there's a stretched horizon, which is some kind of quantum system, and it's got strongly coupled dynamics, and you can think of the dynamics as being local on the stretched horizon, and that's kind of what I'm trying to capture here with this circuit model.
There's sort of holographic point of view in that.
Right. Yeah.
Can you give a sense of how special this circuit model is? I mean, if I just had a bunch of spin one halves on my stretched horizon and coupled them together,
some generic Hamiltonian.
Some kind of simple local Hamiltonian.
Right.
Am I going to get a two design, or am I going to?
I haven't proved it, but I think you would. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So now, if the circuit model can be regarded as a reasonable picture of dynamics, we have to decide what a time step is, right? And so maybe your first impulse would be, well, it's kind of tempting, right? Because it's R log R, which is what we started out with as our cloning limit. Then maybe we can think of this computation taking place in such a way that there's a step in each Planck unit of Schwarzschild time. Okay, and then this would be multiplied by something of order one, and this would actually be the Schwarzschild time for thermalization, if you believe that picture. Well, one oddity of that picture is, from the point of view of local observers who are very close to the horizon, that's really fast, because if you're sitting at this stretched horizon where the local temperature is Planckian, that means you have a very large redshift factor compared to the asymptotic observers where the temperature is the Hawking temperature, right? Because the quanta that escape, by the time they reach infinity, they've redshifted to the Hawking temperature. So there's a redshift factor which is about the Hawking temperature, equivalent to the Schwarzschild radius.
Okay.
So saying that the time scale for this dynamics is the Planck time, Planck unit of Schwarzschild time, means it's much less than the Planck time from the point of view of these local observers. Okay, that sounds kind of hecky. Well, okay, but on the other side of the ledger, one can at least say this, and I not sure how much weight to give to it, but if you think of the stretched horizon in the context in which it was originally discussed and analyzed, from just the classical point of view, the stretched horizon has certain dissipative properties. It has resistance. It has viscosity, and so on. And so, if, for example, in this classical picture, we think of the stretched horizon, you know, some fixed proper distance around above the actual global horizon, and I had to take a charged particle, and I let it drop until it hits the stretched horizon, okay, and now in reality it's actually below it, as seen by Schwarzschild observer. But if what appears to happen is the local charge density that's been absorbed by the stretched horizon spreads out really fast, actually exponentially with respect to Schwarzschild time. So the area of this droplet goes like e to the t over rs. And that means that it actually becomes comparable to the linear size of the black hole in a time, which is about r log r. Now you see, it's really a kinematic effect. It's really just, this is all classical. And the way this kinematic effect arrives, same thing happens in Rindler space, right? In Rindler space, if I consider a uniformly accelerated observer, and then there's this charge moving inertially, like just sitting at rest. And to this observer, it seems to be getting closer and closer to the Rindler horizon. But because this guy is being uniformly accelerated, his clock is slowing down more and more and more. So it looks like the flux lines of the charge are spreading out really quickly. Okay. But from the guy who's fixed in the Schwarzschild coordinates, it looks like you drop the charge, and it explosively expands, and in time of order r log r, it covers the horizon. Now, like I said, it's a kinematic effect. We're interested in dynamics. So I guess I'm saying maybe you can make a case, and I make this case very neatly, that if you're going to have a picture which incorporates this kinematics of the classical phenomena, but also there's strongly coupled dynamics, which is a description of the stretched horizon in the quantum mechanical sense, that we won't be able to cleanly separate anymore this spreading of the electric field lines from other types of spreading on the horizon. That if we want to, at least if we want to use our circuit model to describe this kind of propagation of stuff on the stretched horizon, then we need to have the time scale for the circuit to be short compared to the Planck scale. And if we want to accommodate this spreading of charge that can occur to cover the horizon in a Schwarzschild time, which is of order RS, then I would have to take my time scale to be a Schwarzschild time of order 1 in Planck units. And then I'd be back to concluding that the Schwarzschild time for thermalization is R log R. Okay, so there's some things let me sum up. There's some things that we know that we didn't know back when I first thought about this in 1993, and the main things that we know is that the theory of quantum error correction, which we've known about now for over 10 years, since 1995, and we know about this approximate unitary two design stuff, which is just from last year, which might have some, and both of these things may have some bearing on this question, of what is the information retention time of a black hole. So we've seen, I've structured the argument to, I hope, make it clear, that if thermalization is rapid, then information retention times are short. Okay, so it comes down to how fast is the thermalization, really. It's important to understand that we're talking about thermalization in this global sense. The analysis of these two designs and approximate unitary two designs suggests that, physically plausible dynamics of some kind, which doesn't take a really long time, can thermalize globally well enough for our purposes for this conclusion to hold that information escapes rapidly. But then to try to make a connection between that circuit model, which is something that I kind of know how to analyze, to the actual dynamics of it, that's too hard for me. I mean, it involves really understanding how black holes process information in more detail. But I hope that some of the things that I've said can help to sharpen some of the questions that people try to address in the future while seeking a better understanding of the internal dynamics of black holes. Well, thanks. Yes.
Let me try to put one possible spin on this story, which is assuming a short thermalization time leads to the appearance that the information comes out very rapidly, this mirror effect, which is rather surprising, and that's a suggestion that possibly really the thermalization time or mixing time is much longer.
The only hard limit that I trust to some degree is the one I gave at the beginning, this Coleman argument. So that's the R log R, and the thermalization being as fast as R log R, from that point of view, doesn't seem crazy. But, I agree. This is a question that needs a much more sophisticated analysis to give a really convincing answer.
So, as you said, we can use our ADS-CFT intuition when we're looking about black holes. What's understood about this thermalization time for just gas in a box, not thermalization time, but this mixing scenario and the time scale for hot gas in a box, plasma in a finite S3 cross our universe.
Well, I guess the I was going to ask our quantum chaos expert, the chair, but he had official business to attend to, I'm afraid. Well, I don't know. I mean, I guess I should probably just leave it at that. But I think, I mean, kind of, I mean, what we're saying here in the circuit model, I think maybe is, I mean, I turn it around and say maybe this is, can give one some insight into what happens for other systems.
But in that context, if you use the circuit model for gas in a box or something, it seems like it would, I mean, I can't imagine what other time scale would set the time step aside from the
Well, okay. It certainly has to be strongly coupled dynamics. See, that's the trouble. It has to be something that is hard to analyze for this to be a good model. Because so my picture is, you know, we've got this strongly coupled goo and some kind of local dynamics. And so what are the characteristic scales for that goo? Well, if you really think of it as, you know, thermal stuff at the Planck temperature, and it's some kind of strongly coupled dynamics with the characteristic energy and time scale, which is the Planck scale. And then, and what the circuit model taught us was that thermalization in this global sense, which is often not, you know, analyzed, as you pointed out, when people speak of thermalization times, doesn't have to be much different than the time it takes for information to propagate. You know, because that's really the lesson of this. All we had was this log n slowdown, you know, the log n cost of death to get thermalization that was good enough for our purposes. And so, I mean, I think it's a hard thing to compare with known calculations, because it really is a strongly coupled question.
Another question?
I have actually one or two more, so it may be better if I ask him later.
Yeah, maybe we can.
But so Nima was giving talks on black holes a year or two ago, which I thought the takeaway message was that R log R was not a relevant scale.
Was not a relevant scale.
Right. He wanted to argue that you could really, he had some criterion for the breakdown of low G effective field theory, which he argued led him to argue to the actual black hole lifetime.
That's what Steve says too. And he says the same thing.
Now, I don't think, aside from the force of Nima's personality, I don't think his arguments were, you know, convincing. But I was wondering if you had any talk to Nima about this or had any.
No, I didn't know that he had.
Yeah, he was trying to make a geometric criterion for when you could stop using these slices. You know, how far he wanted to argue you could follow the slice that you drew earlier in your talk, that you could slice it some ways into the black hole.
Right.
Quite a long ways, and basically the point at which you could stop following it was corresponding to an external time m cubed. This, which seems pretty persuasive, would seem to contradict his conclusion that, you know, you wouldn't see deviations from long effective field theory until that time.
Mm-hmm. But does it really contradict that? I mean, in some sense, John's making use of some other deviation from long effective field theory, the fact that the information is coming out from the original black hole on a long time scale.
Yeah, I guess I would emphasize that point, and we'd have to look at exactly what he computed to see whether it's applicable. Because I would agree with the M cubed. Mm-hmm. You know, if we weren't talking about the case in which we had the maximal entanglement to start with.
Yeah. But I would have thought that if you tried to apply his logic to this, you would still need the M cubed even after the sending.
Yeah, well, that's what Giddings was telling me right before the seminar. Actually, that's what he seems.
The statement
he did
was what?
I mean the. I remember saying very clearly, lots of people talk about R log R, but...
Yeah.
And it had to do again with this condition for the slice. You know, he was concerned about the spacing between slices. That was his argument, and he was happy that it gave him M cubed.
Yes. Yeah.
But,
yeah.
You know...
Yeah. So.
But there was no sharp contradiction. There was no real... I mean, it was not something that was...
Well, yeah, I think, well, sort of the motivation for why that argument made sense, having to do with the slicing
we have some differences with, but you know, he was arguing that basically that the mixing takes place on the longest possible time scale, which
yes.
I'm also arguing, you know, although I have a different argument about what goes along with the slices.
Right.
So this story here is based on a story where the mixing takes place on a much shorter time, and so you can get the information out of a much shorter time. But you know, conversely, you know, that's further from the sort of semi-classical answer, which is infinite time that it takes the information.
So Arkani Hamid has a paper about this?
I think, you know, his main goal was to apply it to de Sitter space, where he came up with some, and he wanted to argue that you didn't have to restrict to one causal patch, but like of order E to the S causal patches.
Yeah, there's a paper on cosmology, and I think he talks about this, his sort of space in between slices argument.
In there, right.
But again, didn't manage to convince any of us about the space in between slices. So.
But the quark gluon plasma, the dual thing, would presumably fix. I mean, would be fast mixing. You'd think even in the strong sense of mixing. I mean, each bit can talk to every other bit on a time scale.
A strongly coupled
point across some time. Yeah, yeah.
Strongly coupled. Yeah, that's what I would be arguing. Because
yeah.
I mean, it didn't really matter that it was a black hole for the
for
the sake of this circuit analogy. It was just some kind of strongly coupled local dynamics that I was trying to model.
Okay, well, maybe we should officially end the seminar and thank John again.